Welcome to this special edition series, A Strategic View of Hiring, a series of discussions to help you think through and implement smarter and more impactful strategies to recruit and develop world-class talent for your organization. And now, here is our series host, Mr. Rick Thiemann.
Welcome back to A Strategic View of Hiring. I am your host, Todd Schnick, joined by my friend and our series host, Mr. Rick Thiemann. Rick, my friend, good to see you. Welcome back.
Absolutely, man. It's great to see you. I love these kinds of conversations.
Well, we're building a nice library of content with this series and with every episode, as I suspect will be no different today. I continue to just learn some amazing things. Today, we're going to focus, again, thinking in the context of hiring. We're going to talk about behavior. Now, I'll read from your book, Developing World-Class Leaders. Behavior is the single biggest predictor of performance, more than job skills, experience, education, or even critical thinking skills, which is fascinating because I think, and I'll kick this off by saying, I think our hiring process, your typical average corporate hiring process, I think does a rather poor job of trying to understand a candidate's behavior. Yeah.
Well, I'm not sure most HR managers would acknowledge that their systems are perhaps flawed, but yeah, in the 31 years I've done this, I think there's a lot of room for improvement, without a doubt. Even as long as the world of interviewing and assessments has been in place, there's still a lot of gaps.
Well, there's a lot to unpack here. And I guess one interesting way to kind of think about this in the context of your HR department or the hiring process is understanding the reasons we hire versus the reasons we fire. Talk about that.
Yeah, that's a concept I love, and I talk about it in the book. But we hire for experience, education, skill level, and more often than not, we hire for personal chemistry. But if you stop and think about the difference between why we hire, why we fire for a different set of criteria than what we hired for. And the criteria we hire for, again, is skills, education, background, experience, education, degrees, and what have you. And again, personal chemistry. But we fire for a whole different set of reasons. We fire for poor performance, personality quirks, poor attitude, lack of interpersonal skills, not the greatest problem solvers, has trouble getting up to speed in their role, doesn't show up for work, takes advantage of their position. I mean, there's a litany of reasons why we fire people. So why don't we spend more time interviewing around the things we wind up firing for? In other words, poor performance. Why don't we spend more time in our interview process looking at those things or uncovering those things versus the reasons why we typically do hire, and that is basically off the quality of the resume.
All right. Well, thinking about what you just said, you just listed off a number of reasons why we fire. And it's fascinating to think about the distinction between how we hire people and why we fire them and how, again, sort of echoing the line I said earlier about how we do a poor job understanding behavior, I'm realizing now that this whole series that we're putting together here, Strategic View Hiring, and we've talked about things about how to do a better interview, how to do phone screens, how to validate references. I now understand that one of the key reasons we talk about those other subjects is to help you unpeel the onion there to better understand someone's behavior or potential behavior, right?
Well, if you stop and think about the number of times an HR person has to let someone go, it's usually performance driven. And that performance usually ties back to some type of behavioral issue. And in part of my practice as an executive coach is I have 22 executives I'm coaching right now. And it's basically driven because they've got some challenges around how they operate as leaders, is why I'm being brought in to see if I can help them get themselves to the next level or get themselves turned around. And many of those 22 coaching assignments I'm literally working with live right now, most of them are driven around some behavioral piece that they're having problems getting past. So when you think about the reasons why we fire, the reasons why an executive coach is brought in, oftentimes it's for development. Oftentimes it's to help that person in promotion. And I have some of those people I'm coaching as well. But oftentimes there's a behavioral-based element that's tied to that coaching exercise, no different than the behavioral-based element that's tied to the reasons why we tend to fire people.
So if I heard you correctly, as we record this, you have 22 coaching clients you're working with right now. I think you've coached hundreds of people in your career. You're not coaching people who don't understand their product or understand how to do the job they were hired to do. you're coaching people who have flaws in their behavior, right? I mean, that's a lot of the work that you're focusing on is not lack of skill.
Well, sometimes it is. Sometimes it's a lack of a competency, right? I mean, the typical example is most managers don't delegate very well. Well, it's a skill set. It's also driven by your behavior, but that's a whole other topic. But yeah, in many cases, there's a lot of behavioral things tied to it. For example, let's say that I've got a manager who tends to be cautious, conservative, analytical, risk averse, wants to make the right decisions, likes to research everything in their path, the old analysis by paralysis kind of thing, right?
Right.
Or paralysis by analysis. But from that standpoint, then, if part of the job is to drive change, or to come up with new ideas and innovative ways to manage processes, procedures, that's not how they're wired. So you're asking them to work counter to their behavior. Now, yeah, that's a skill set you can develop through a number of coaching strategies that we might use to help a person kind of shift their thinking and shift their thought process and learn new competencies. But now, in some cases, you're asking them to change a behavior. Well, people aren't going to really change a behavior as much as they're going to learn how to modify that behavior. So to expect Robin Williams to ever take a serious approach to anything in his life probably was never going to happen, right? So people have to learn how to modify certain elements of their behavior. But nonetheless, it still comes down to you've got to make a conscious effort to change it. And some people just have a hard time doing that.
Well, speaking for myself, because this is opening up my eyes to a whole new way of looking at certainly how I identify potentially good candidates for an organization and hiring processes is this whole idea of thinking about understanding their behavior. And there's so many different paths we can go down here. But help me understand behavior itself. I mean, I imagine there's different ways to look at it. I mean, there's reliable and there's unreliable behavior, right? And that's important to understand the distinction between those two.
Yeah. So when you think of reliable behavior versus unreliable behavior, you can almost translate that into normal versus abnormal.
Mm.
Right? So what's a normal behavior? Maintains their calm, maintains their cool, willing to work with difficult situations, respect for others, strong commitment to a strong work ethic, emotionally resilient, able to reflect on their mistakes, seeks feedback, consistently gets good results. I mean, those are things that you'd like every employee to have, but the sad part is not every employee has all those.
Right.
But when you interview someone, that's the image they want you to see, and that's the image they present, and they present that strong image in their resume. Because no one ever embellishes a resume, right? No one ever talks about their liabilities. So when you think of reliable behaviors, it's good people doing good work, right? And wouldn't it be great if all of your people in your company were good people who did good work?
Well, then it would be really simple. We did a whole episode in this series on validating references. I mean, one of the key tenets of that is to really get the core of people's behavior, right? And really understand that, seek to understand that.
Right, absolutely. Now, when you look at the other side, the unreliable behaviors, so what are the behaviors that show up that become problematic? Well, it's such as a high need for social approval, or someone who doesn't pick up on the social cues of others, or somebody who doesn't possess a whole lot of self-insight, or even worse, you know, makes decisions in isolation, anger and aggressive tendencies, passive-aggressive, what we call dominant-dependent. That's a whole other topic. But, you know, even the egotist or the narcissist, right? People who talk down to others, the condescending behavior, those are abnormal behaviors. And there's even worse behaviors than that we can get into, and we can talk about that in a minute. So when you start looking about how do I determine if this person has any undesirable qualities, well, the standard interview process and even the reference checking process, even as much as we teach how to be better at that piece, isn't going to reveal, for the most part, anything that really might be quirky.
Well, listening to that list that you just went through on the unreliable or the abnormal behaviors, I'm thinking about your typical corporate environment says, well, what gets measured gets managed. I mean, someone can say to you, well, Rick, how the heck am I going to know if someone may not possess enough self-insight? How the heck do I determine that? Is there, in fact, a way to measure behavior?
There is. And that gets into kind of the assessment world. But there's a very highly recognized format referred to as behavioral-based interviewing. And you can use some of that behavioral-based interviewing strategies, but it has its own flaws in and of itself because it depends on the level of training the person has around the behavioral-based interviewing model. That's number one. Number two, that you need constant reinforcement and training on how to be really effective at the behavioral-based interviewing piece. But the sad part is most people believe that they're really a good judge of character. That's one of the biggest hiring myths in the world. I'm a good judge of character, or I know a good one when I see one. Come on, really? But so many people believe that they are. And after 31 years of doing this, and I've done quite a few, I don't even trust myself in an interview, as many people as I've interviewed, because people are really good at kind of telling their own story the way they believe their story exists, right or wrong, right? So being able to tease that out in the interview process really requires an ability to understand how to interview effectively.
Well, looking back on our segments on interviews, I mean, we talked about the struggles and the challenges that an organization will face in that process. And thinking back on that, I'm recognizing now how someone could say, well, it's harder than it sounds to try to determine and understand someone's behavior. But you touched on it a second ago. I mean, there is a wonderful process by which we can surprisingly really get a good sense of someone's behavioral activity. And it is through those assessments that you mentioned a second ago. So, I mean, gosh, we're going to go much more in depth on the assessment process later in this series, but it's very relevant in this conversation around trying to understand someone's behavior. So talk about how an assessment, a proper assessment process, can make a big difference here.
Let's look at a really ugly behavior. Let's take the narcissist, okay? Obviously, that person in an interview is going to come across as confident, right? And so how do you determine the difference between confidence and arrogance? Well, sometimes you can pick that out and sometimes you can't. But the highly aggressive person, highly confident person who's got a high level of intellect might have more problems than you might realize. And what I mean by that is they could have what we call an intellectualized hostility. In other words, they think they're the smartest person in the room and they're always talking down to everybody else who isn't as smart as they are. But how do you really know if that's borderline or if that's, you know? And the only way to really do that is to really have a quality assessment, more, I would say, a sophisticated assessment. There's a lot of quality assessments that aren't sophisticated, but I would say you need a sophisticated assessment that starts to measure that. But when you look at the world of really true abnormal behaviors, think about this. Think of the person who's angry at the world and has a chip on their shoulder and is prone to fight. Are you going to pick that out in an interview? Right? Probably not. Think of the person who's the idealist who's tended to be out of touch with reality.
I don't even know how to ask a question to get that kind of a...
Oh, those are... It's tough. And especially when you think about what we talked about in the interview process is that most interviews go about an hour. How are you going to get that kind of information out in an hour? How are you going to see that? Probably not. Maybe. But you'd have to know what to really ask. But that's an art form.
Right.
But when you look at things like, how would you know if somebody's highly impatient and critical of others and the things around them and then gets irritable when things don't move as fast as they want them to? How are you going to pick that out in an interview? You might, but
probably not.
Probably not. So how do you really start to look at the really ugly side of some people versus people who, you know, you just some days you can take them, some days you can leave them. But some people, it's some day you can just forget about them, right? They become very difficult to work with. Well, again, back to the behavioral piece, those are the people that usually wind up alienating people around them and then just creates a caustic environment. And then destroys the culture and the morale that you're trying to equate because you've got the wrong person in the wrong role with the wrong temperament. The only way to really look at that truly is the assessment process, the assessment world.
I get it. I understand that. But here's my problem. I looked at the shelf of all the different types of assessment tools, and there's a lot of them. Are there better ones than others? Then I worry about it's going to spin off a report. How skilled do I have to be to interpret that? I mean, you've done over 20,000 assessments in your career. I suspect you have an answer on what kind of assessment to use and what skills may or may not be necessary to effectively interpret the results of these things.
There's no J.D. Power and Associates rating and ranking scale for assessments. It's not out there. The only tool that's out there that can give you some resemblance of order is the Burroughs Mental Measurements Yearbook. What is that, right? Well, it's an independent research study that evaluates different assessments on the market and then provides a descriptor of whether or not that's a quality assessment or not. Many of assessments on the market that are used, there's one in particular, and I won't name because I'm not going to throw it under the bus, but one of the most prominent assessments on the market has been the Burroughs Mental Measurements Yearbook has reached out to them to see if they would provide data to be evaluated by a third party. They've refused. On two different occasions, unless that's happened in the last several years, but in the research I've done on the assessments that are in the marketplace, to date, they've not been willing to disclose their information to be publicly audited, if you will. So when you think about validity, right, every test on the market is validated. The question is not if they're validated, because they all are, but validated by who and to what extreme or to what extent. Meaning, it's like General Motors doing their own crash test, right? instead of having an initial safety board do the crash test and then provide feedback to J.D. Powers, right? There's many assessments that have never been evaluated by an independent auditor. So how would you know how validated they really are and to what extent and against what standards? And then beyond that, the reliability is how reliable are they? But that's a whole other topic on assessments that gets pretty in-depth. But the piece is, if you're not working with us with a more sophisticated tool versus some of the more simpler ones on the market, you're going to have a hard time picking out somebody's abnormal behaviors or unreliable behaviors that we're speaking to because they're not sophisticated enough to dig out that kind of behavior.
Well, if I'm correct in interpreting, I've read your book and I've listened to your other presentations on assessments, there's not one perfect assessment. In fact, in your 31 plus years of doing this and the 20,000 plus assessments you've done, you've, over this time, you've compiled a pretty comprehensive battery of assessments. And so you use several different kinds, and also you adjust that based on the kind of person you are, what kind of role that they're hiring for. And so this is a fluid process, but you can begin to truly understand someone's behavior through an effective implementation of an assessment process, though, is the fair statement to make.
Yeah. I started this practice in 1991 using the DISC. And the DISC is a neat little tool. Predictive Index and several others are along those same lines. But I soon realized very early on that the DISC was not an end-all be-all, was not as robust as I needed. It was good for an information tool. It was good for a feedback tool. It was good for a team-building tool.
Right.
It still is. And I've done thousands of them. But it's not a sophisticated tool. It's a simple tool. And it mirrors the predictive index. It mirrors the Myers-Briggs. It mirrors the Berkman, Caliper, and a host of others. But if you were to throw all the assessments in the world into a pile and ask someone to pick out the best one or the top three, personally, I think they'd be hard-pressed to do that.
Yeah.
Because you have the culture index, which is a takeoff of the predictive index. You have the extended DISC, which is a takeoff of the DISC. You have the California personality inventory. You have the Hogan. You have the Neo, the strong interest, the Harrison, the Colby. And I could go on listing the assessments on the market. Well, how would you know which one is the best? How would you know how to categorize them? So what I've done is I've taken all of these assessments and I've categorized them into the difference between what's a behavioral assessment, what's a psychological assessment, and what's a clinical assessment. And then you identify those tools that create the best type of output. So in the battery of assessments that I've created over the years that I've been using for a long, long time, is I have four standard assessments I use. And given the role, sometimes I might extend that to even five or even six assessments because I don't believe that one assessment really fits all. But if I was going to choose one that was going to be what I felt is my go-to, and I could only use one, like only one bullet in my gun, right? What gun would I use and what bullet would I use? I would use the Watterson Personality Inventory all day long. And we can go into a whole lot of litany of why. But my point is, it's a psychological tool, not a behavioral tool. And where your behavioral tools, such as DISC, Predictive Index, Berkman, and some of the others, those behavioral tools only measure four dimensions of behavior. My one tool that I would choose, if it's the only one I had to choose, measures 16 dimensions of behavior. So which one do you think is going to measure behavior more broadly and more deeply? Obviously, one with 16 dimensions versus four, right?
Right.
But I don't stop there. I also use a cognitive reasoning test. I use a perceptual reasoning test. I use an inductive and deductive reasoning test. And I use a companion psychological test along with a behavioral test. Why? Because it's harder for them to fool a battery of assessments than just fool one. Because you get into a whole litany of things called distortion and test content and test construct, things we could talk about in another session on assessments. But my point is, how do you know if you're using a sophisticated tool versus just one that's been validated and gives you a computer-generated report?
Well, all those things that you just listed, validity versus reliability and distortion and test construct and content and all these different things will be a subject on another episode of the show as we go deeper into assessments and that process. And you have written extensively on that in your book, Developing World-Class Leaders. So there's plenty of material there.
Yeah, chapter six in the book, I lay out the difference in assessments. And one of the chapters I talk about create an assessment battery.
Yeah.
About what that looks like in one of the chapters. I think it's chapter.
Well, you talk in depth about several of these actual assessments and positives and negatives. And I can vouch, before we went into the studio to record this episode, you were on the phone with your staff and you two were kind of playing chess with different assessments for a particular client with a specific goal in mind. So I saw it really happen in terms of how you were kind of managing this battery of assessments that you've compiled
Yeah, the battery depends, you know, sometimes a battery unfortunately comes to a cost factor. A client doesn't want to spend, you're only willing to spend X amount of dollars. All right. Well, so then we have to figure out to get within that budget, what's the right tool to use that still gives them a level of quality of information at a fair market price. Now, you can go on to Myers-Briggs and for, I think it's $40, you can get the Myers-Briggs, but it reads like a horoscope.
Right.
I mean, it doesn't measure, and those aren't my words. That's the psychologist I met in Denver who actually uses the Myers-Briggs and likes it, but states this is, it's really nothing more than a horoscope.
Well, 200 coaching clients, 20,000 plus assessments, I consider you a psychologist, just so you know. No, I'll read again from your book, Developing World-Class Leaders. In an effort to raise productivity and performance, a company can use assessments to improve their bottom line, reduce turnover, save on hiring costs, aid in succession planning, and help target leadership development. I think you make the case there why an organization needs to take this seriously.
Well, what I try to encourage clients
is... Not to mention understanding prospect behavior.
Yeah, right. I'm a believer that says, okay, no one walks on water. To hire the perfect candidate, it's pretty unlikely. So how do we use the assessment, not only to determine whether or not it's a good or bad hire, but if we do hire them, what's the area of development that we need to start out with right away to help them become effective and hit the ground running? So you learn to create a development plan out of the information that says, okay, so we've identified some potential gaps. Now, if those things happen once they get hired, then it's not like we're catching them off guard, right? So now we've seen the behavior play out, and now we know what type of either A, corrective action or coaching. So I do a lot of feedback to clients that 90 days after we've hired this person, you know, how are they working out? Is what we thought we'd see, you know, playing out? And how do we then help work towards that? I got an email from a client that said basically it was something like this. Rick, seems like the book is going well. Several months back, you gave some feedback on Mr. B. You suggested that he may have a temper. Oh, I told him, I said I thought he would have some temperament issues, maybe even some underlying anger. And the email went on to say, we've seen some recent outbursts and then recently put his fist through a controller in the plant. So here we identified that this guy maybe has some anger issues. But when you start to look at then what the assessment tells you, and knowing that our assessment has the ability to be as far-reaching as anger, aggression, emotional resilience, emotional instability, you know, a sophisticated assessment can measure those kind of behaviors, that your DISC and predictive index and Myers-Briggs, and I keep naming those, but everybody's pretty familiar with those. There's the Berkman, there's the Caliper. But the thing is that if you don't know what your test is actually measuring, then you need to make sure you're working with a skilled practitioner who's been around the block, knows what they're selling you, knows what they're providing, and knows how to use it in such a way that really provides value to you as the organization.
All right. On that note, that wraps this discussion around behavior. Rick, how do people contact you should they have any questions on the subject of candidate behavior or assessments or any of the subjects in this series?
My website is www.theeg or theeg.com, which is short for the executive group. My email is rick@theeg.com, so they can reach me there. Anybody who's interested in a copy of the book, I'm more than happy to provide a free copy. I'll even pick up the shipping if they'd like a copy, or they can order it through Amazon.
And that book, again, is called Developing World-Class Leaders.
The Ultimate Guide to Leadership Development.
Outstanding. All right. Well, that's all the time that we have for today. On behalf of our series host, Rick Thiemann, I am Todd Schnick. Thank you for tuning in and listening to A Strategic View of Hiring.
Thanks for listening to the special edition series, A Strategic View of Hiring. This series is made possible by the Executive Group, linking human capital with strategic intent, building organizational talent, and developing both world-class leaders and Salesforce effectiveness. To learn more, visit the Executive Group online at theeg.com. That's theeg.com.